Yes, and that's to be contrasted with empathy and love, because empathy and love is like sort of using that energy with other people and not presenting it as a power or energy in itself that can control other people's, at least other people's sort of, or get other people's attention, their reaction. As I say, I don't know exactly what can be harnessed with it, as it's a real tangible form of energy or not. I don't know.
Well, charisma is, we do experience charisma. It's one of those mysteries, like who has it and who doesn't. It's somewhat subjective, but not really. As I was asking you about with anthropology, because what's his name, George P. Hansen, Trickster and Paranormal, he brought it up at the end of the first podcast that I did in this series, very specifically right towards the end. He said, and I'm just looking online now because it comes from Max Weber, the anthropologist who wrote about liminality. It says here, charisma is central to Max Weber's theories of authority, power and domination. He clearly explained that pure charisma required the working of miracles, and he specifically mentioned prophecy, telepathy and weather control as manifestations of pure charisma.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, going back to my own experience with these two people who had charisma, I've got to say I don't think either of them were psychic. So I'm not, and as I say, one of them being a singer had a certain presence on stage, although she's not a well-known name or anything like that. Someone else I do know who had psychic or does have psychic abilities doesn't fall into the category as someone who's charismatic particularly.
No, I would agree with that, although I think there is an overlap. I mean, this guy I was telling you about that I met, he was definitely a charismatic and he was psychic. But on the other hand, I would agree, I've known people who are charismatic that didn't have obvious woo-woo powers, whatever you want to call that. But then isn't that what we're exploring now here, is, you know, what is psychism? The assumption that it means that you can, you know, conjure thunderbolts out of the sky or read people's minds is perhaps unnecessarily limiting in terms of, I mean, because charisma relates to some extent, I imagine, to giving people what they want, letting people see what they want to see in some way.
Which could also relate to their lack of self, because if they have an absence, then other people who are around them can perhaps project all of their fantasies into that person and fill them with their own, you know, subjective fantasies.
Yeah, well, there'd be some sort of symbiosis going on, which, as I say, would be like psychism in a wider definition, it's like negative empathy or something, because it would also go the other way, that if a charismatic, and I think this probably is true of someone like Hitler or Jim Jones, from things I've read, that in a way they're kind of blank, and it's what the other person projects onto them, which have based their deepest desires, really, that's what they see, that's what the person sees.
I've got to say, I'm not sure with either of those whether we can be sure about them, because I've been reading recently that Hitler got a lot of training from a magician, so as we see him speak publicly, that was very different from his behaviour as a private person, obviously, and he got a lot of training from, I think it was a magician or psychic called Jan Hanussen, and then he died soon after Hitler got power. He was found dead in a forest, so he's probably assassinated. But he gave Hitler a lot of his kind of training in like being a magician. Really, it's like if you're a magician, you know how you can train. He can train someone to make the most. With the gesture, sort of, again, it's body language and gesture and the way you speak, everything. I think Hitler was trained over quite a long period, in fact, a year or two, to do all that back in long before he got, became chancellor or anything. And there was someone else you mentioned. Jim Jones, another one. I think it obviously connected with the CIA. and then
sure, yeah, but it's not either or, is it? Because they wouldn't just pick anyone, and not just anyone could be trained either. So, and also somebody who was traumatized in order to have natural charisma would still need training, right? Because otherwise they could just be all over the place. So, I don't think that is a counter argument. I think that adds more to it, for sure. Like, you know, if a person is, if their psyche is fractured in such a way that they have potential access to the psychic energy that's leaking through that fissure, they still have to learn how to direct it. I mean, obviously speaking metaphorically here, but you have to speak metaphorically when you talk about the psyche. You know how, and this is what MK Ultra was about, which I think I'm beginning to think it was, that it was, you know, the popular idea of MK Ultra was that it was about creating super spies, undercover agents who wouldn't even know that they were agents, and so on, and warrior, you know, psychic warriors. Yeah, maybe, but I think that much less talked about areas, it was about creating false ceremony masters, cultural leaders who had to, yeah, be trained to direct that charisma in a way that would, or to develop it as charisma, really, to direct that leaking psychic energy and turn it into charisma. So for every 1,000, you know, drug addicts and early suicides, you would get one Leonard Cohen. That was my guess about that. And that would be the one that they would, you know, or there'd be a few that they would, you know, work with. And then out of those, there'd be one or two that actually they were able to successfully. And I don't like saying they, because I really don't know how much is hands-on and how much of it can happen organically. You know, once you've had a culture that self-engineered itself over millennia in the ways that we're discussing, through the ego's own defense strategies, then the culture itself will kind of take care of these. But you can imagine that somebody who was traumatized through MK Ultra, let's say Leonard Cohen, as a child, and then they observe that person growing up, and then they, okay, so look, he's learning guitar, good. He picked up that cue or that post hypnotic suggestion. Okay, so now he's going to go and play a gig. Let's send some people to make sure that there's a lot of people at the gig. You know, that there are ways that sort of nuts and bolts social engineering could overlap with the much subtler kind, which doesn't involve any kind of control or direction, because it's all implanted in the individual. But certainly opening doors for somebody and facilitating their success once you see that they've taken the program and that they've developed the charisma that is going to serve the agendas. So, I mean, that's one interpretation of Hitler, isn't it? Is that he was only partly a free agent. That there's one book I read about Hitler, it was interesting, about that because he was blinded in World War II, and then he was cured through hypnosis. Did you read about that?
Yes, I have read something about that,
So the book I read was about how during that period the doctor who cured him was also incepting in him, if that's the right term, but anyway, ideas about Jews and about society, and that later Hitler developed as if they were his own into his policies.
Well, I think that there's a lot to be said for the fact that I think Hitler was more directed than directing, in fact, that he may not have, but probably didn't realise this to the end. I mean, he thought that he'd been betrayed by everyone else, and he didn't realise that he could have been a puppet. I suppose that's what I'm thinking of, a puppet. Mm. And even you could extend that to what happened in Russia with the Russian Revolution, which, this is all a big sort of historical context about Britain being wary of being displaced by its two rivals, which were, like, at the beginning of the 20th century, Germany and Russia, the two big rivals coming up to not to confront Britain aggressively, but potentially. And so Britain was going to preempt that potential rivalry by making sure that both of those countries were neutralised. And that's a sort of long, long process. In a way, it's the history of the last 100 years or so, how British foreign policy was devised to make sure that Germany and Russia did not dominate the world. But so Hitler was a leading part of that. But behind it was a lot of, it's really, I would say, British and then later Anglo-Americans foreign policy and how to rule things.
That's interesting. I've not heard that theory before. My grandfather went to Russia in the 50s and before that, and it was curious to me, like, how and why he did that. I haven't been able to find any clues about what he was doing there and how he managed. I mean, the official version, he was there as a church member because he was a Quaker. But I, taking into account his other affiliations to people like Bertrand Russell and J.B. Priestley and some heavy hitters in the sort of propaganda wars of the 30s and 40s and 50s. I have to say, I think there's some unanswered questions for me about that, you know, what was going on there. Well, so I just wonder, it might overlap with what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Britain achieved was a sort of, it was successful in neutralising Germany and Russia, because you just look at the losses of in the both world wars, and the Germans lost more and the Russians lost, you know, they were the two countries that actually lost most. Okay, Britain did lose life as well, but not at all to the same extent as the Germans and the Russians did. But we can always say, well, they were the they were the guilty party, or Germany was the guilty party, and so that's how we can justify it. But there was a quote from Sir Winston Churchill, which I like, because he's saying, "History will remember me kindly because I am the one who is writing it." So that's the context we're living in, isn't it? And
that's the crucial fiction now. That's right. The ego is the one who gets to define the narrative.
And on the other side, especially in Germany, they're the victims, and they see themselves as guilty because they are. It's like a sort of, you know, I went to Germany when I was at school because I studied German, and I stayed with a family there, and we were actually not far away from Dachau in Nuremberg, and a friend of mine asked her in the pub like what she felt about the war. And quite not a polite thing to do, but, and she sort of then hung her head in shame and, you know, said to her, feel ashamed, you know. And that's,
how old was she?
Well, it was about 18, you know. And it was,
incredible.
She wasn't born, you know, in the war. But, you know, obviously her mother, I think... No, I spoke to her mother at breakfast, and she was saying about her father having to walk 200 miles or something at the end of the war. He was actually starving, and then, like, walking, I suppose, from Russia back. I think he was in the front there, in the Eastern Front, and then walking back home. And he was like a death's door, like walking like 200 miles in the end of the war. So there's a lot there, which obviously we're dealing with trauma on a huge scale, aren't we? I mean, that's on a huge social scale that can't be dealt with at all. I mean, it's really so overwhelming.
You're talking about fear as a way to control people. Well, shame is another primary one. So.
Yes, and that's right. And I think that's definitely, there's an element of or control there, and that's a deliberate thing going on there. Because that's the whole shape of Europe has obviously kind of changed since there. So, I mean, we've had.
And that was the period that the CIA came into being, and the UFO phenomena started in earnest, the flying saucers and MKUltra. And so that was a massively transitional period in terms of geopolitics and the collective psyche and everything else.
Yes, and in the war as well, apart from Britain, you had Switzerland, which is an interesting, a lot of interesting things went on there with both Carl Jung and Alan Dulles being resident in Switzerland
yeah.
during the war, and they had contact.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of things probably, you know, which we don't know much about, has sort of dialogue went on there. Not direct, they did meet each other, I know, but they had mutual friends. I think a lot probably came out of that, which was developed then after the war in America.
Hmm. It does feel, I mean, it's kind of intuitive now, but it does feel as though, in a way, not in a way, I'm just saying it's this way that it feels. So in some sense, that the cultural consensus that we're in now, it's as though it was written during that period. I mean, I think it was written long ago, and it was, but I think there are periods, it's like liminality, you know. Liminality is a period in which new programs can be inserted because the old ones are collapsing. So you get the psyche or the collective, you know, a whole nation or a whole species, even in this liminal state of actually not knowing what to believe, then they're vulnerable to false beliefs, especially if there's anxiety, intense anxiety, danger, life-threatening situation. They won't be able to wait just to find out what's real. They won't be able to do their own autonomous explorations to find out. They will just gratefully resist being herded, really. They will gratefully receive the herding that will direct them into the reality tunnel that has been prepared for them. So then, this is kind of sense I'm getting, because we've went all the way out into geopolitics very quickly there, but it does all seem interconnected, and it seems as though that period that we're talking about, the end of World War II, the defeat of the Nazis, the creation of the CIA and the security state, all that, and the communization of Russia and the UFO, it's still liminal now, because if you look back at the UFO, we still don't know what the hell happened at Roswell. That's liminal. We actually, in my opinion, don't know what happened in Germany with the so-called Holocaust.
Mm.
Because if we did, there wouldn't be so much controversy around it. There wouldn't be laws being passed saying you can't question the narrative, I don't think. So I actually hardly talk about the subject, because I honestly don't know. I don't know what happened, and I don't know what to believe, you know? I mean, it's true about everything, but particularly this period, it seems as though it was actually a period in which history got rewritten, and it was such a profound the impact of whatever did happen was so profound. Again, the trauma, it's like we dissociated historically, because then we entered into this false narrative about, and I think we already were in one, so we're just talking about different stages of something, but still, it's almost visible to us, right? Neither of us were born, but I obviously had family members. My grandfather was too young to fight in World War I and too old to fight in World War II, and so he didn't go to the war. But anyway, that's all side stuff. I just mean that we're still close enough to it to feel as though there is a reality there that we can refer to. But, you know, a couple more generations, that's it. Like, there's going to be nobody to actually say what happened, even if we could believe them. So it's like the history books, you know, the dictated narrative has replaced experience.
Mm. I think there's a lot in the, obviously the state of Israel wouldn't exist without the Holocaust, would it? I don't think.
No. Yeah.
And of course the state of Israel is important for its geographical location in the Middle East, where of course all the large deposits of oil are, cheap oil anyway, you know, Saudi Arabia and so on. And I think that's, and of course it's allowed, it's got a lot of nuclear weapons, which,
and it's the Holy Land.
Yes.
So
yes.
So it's as being valuable real estate that goes back at least, well, 4,000 years at least, no?
Yeah, so I mean, it has a very important strategic that value there. I mean, that's why, and I suppose that's why this narrative, whether it's true or false, I mean, I don't have any view really, because I haven't looked into the subject, and I'm not sure I want to really.
Same.
The effect is that that's why it we have. I'd say it's a Western power in. Well, some people say it's the other way around. It's Israel that controls everywhere else. I'm not so sure about that, but it's.
Well, it may be. I wish there was a word for this, what I want to describe, but neither, anyway, as in that whatever's controlling it is on a higher level than both, so it comes through Israel, but then it also comes through, you know what I mean? So they're trying to make it linear is probably a mistake,
And of course,
which is,
Zionism goes back before all this. It goes back to the 19th century, doesn't it? At least, so it's something that was already being spoken about. And mainly in England, so it's mainly something that came out of this country, I think, because.
right. On top of the world. Well, you know, that's a bit of a leap here, but I always like to bring it in as well as going outward. And I was saying how this geopolitics kind of reflects the way in which the psyche fragments and one part becomes dominant. There is something about Israel. I mean, I've never been there, but I've met people from there, and I've heard many accounts of just how difficult Israelis are, how self-important, let's say, to use not too charged a term, I hope, and that would reflect the constructed identity. And Israel was constructed; it's a construct. I mean, not every country is, but we're talking about a very recent one, no? And there's still contention. There's still another aspect of the psyche, that's Palestine, saying, "No, you don't belong here." So it's like that. It's kind of like that fragmentation of the psyche and the vying for power of the different fragments. We can see it on the world stage in that way, and it's very divisive. I mean, it's within us as well. Like, I don't talk about Israel because I don't know anything about it, but I wouldn't want to talk about Israel with anyone on the off chance that they had strong feelings about it. Because, I mean, I actually have strong feelings about Israel and I know nothing about it. You know, I just because I picked it up from here and there and I feel strongly about it. So if anyone is pro-Israel, I don't want to talk to them. I mean, not literally. I talked to Jim Kunstler. He's pro-Israel, but I certainly wouldn't talk to him about Israel. My God, you know, just stay away from it. So how is that, you know, something so charged? It's like, because it hasn't established itself. Like, the narrative hasn't established itself.
Maybe is it a little like people who think 9/11 was an inside job, and those who don't? I mean, that's another kind of example, isn't it? That you've got a divide line, and it's a very, very difficult to have a dialogue from one to the other. It's like there's a wall dividing people, because if you're going to change your view on something really important, it is a very, you could almost use the word trauma as a you undergo something traumatic when you change. It's like you could actually say it's you're changing your mind about something, and something's been part of you through your life or for however many
I
years.
think it's re yeah, it feels unsafe because if the constructed identity is built on basically beliefs that are a form of defense, if you start to lower, if you let go of one belief, you could feel that the whole thing will collapse.
Because I have noticed that myself with conversations with, or when bringing up the subject of 9/11, for example, which well, I changed my view about it myself. I didn't have anyone persuade me in a conversation. It was just things that I happened to read about, which led me to change my original perspective on it, which was, my original was like the majority, I presumably still majority view, that is what we hear on the news and so on, that this is like sort of evil terrorists who are obviously an external threat that make us all should make us all afraid, because we are living in a world of terror. And then I changed by reading more about facts and things that went on that day and things that happened that didn't make sense according to that view. Then I began to question all of that, and it was a wasn't an overnight thing, but it was a process that obviously it did have an impact on my life, because it changed, in a way, it changed my paradigm, the way of looking at the world. My whole sort of world view changed, but it's not to say that it became completely the reverse of what it was. But I was interested to read quite recently about, you know, the rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, who went from Nazi Germany over to America, and obviously the man mainly responsible for sending people to the moon, apparently. But when he was dying of cancer in the 1970s, he apparently spoke to his secretary and said, "It's such a shame, because we've got this false enemy, which was back then, which is communism." And he said, "And when that goes," so he sort of knew, he could sort of foresee the future. And he said, "Then when that's gone, we will have a new false energy enemy, which will be the terrorists." And so then he said, "The final false enemy will be the aliens." Yeah, and that's interesting, because it could be that at some point, that's when perhaps people see through. I mean, I suppose you could say I and you have both seen through the idea of terrorism as a genuine threat. As well, it's rather more sort of a fabricated terrorism. And if perhaps there comes a certain threshold and more people start to disbelieve the official narrative about that, then perhaps at that point there will have to be a new narrative, which, according to Wernher von Braun, you know, and this could explain a lot of things that have happened since Roswell as well, that all this sort of strange, neither affirming nor denying on behalf of governments and so on about UFOs and alien life and so on, and even this, what Struve's been writing about, all of this could be there as an agenda that hasn't been triggered, but that at a certain point, perhaps not long from now, in the near rather than long-term future, could be triggered, and all it needs is something in society, that something happened, and then someone you trigger it, and then I'm not saying I have no idea what it could be or when it could be, but it's a possibility, isn't it? Because it's like all these projects. I read that about the First World War as well, that was kind of, the First World War was engineered into being through British foreign policy, and that Germany had to go through Belgium. But there was a possibility that Germany didn't want to go into Belgium and contravene sort of a certain sort of fuzzy law about sort of Belgian neutrality by sending troops into Belgium. And so there was a plan B that was to do with a force going to Ireland, a German force, and this involved a fiction writer called Erskine Childers. So he wrote fiction, he wrote novels, but he also was involved with the British intelligence, and he had a plan to involve Germans going to Ireland, so to kind of stage a force invasion of Ireland, a German invasion of Ireland. That was a sort of plan B, but it had to be cancelled rapidly once it was known that Germany had actually gone into Belgium, and at that point people behind the government could make sure that Britain declare war on Germany with some sort of legitimacy. But there was this other, there's always a plan B, or maybe there's a plan C, plan D as well. But it's like, if certain some things don't work, then you've got an alternative plan that can be put into operation. And it seems maybe that's where all this stuff about aliens and so on can be used.
Well, that's certainly a theory that's been around for some time. I remember saying to Jello Biafra, the Dead Kennedys guy, one occasion that I met him, and I was on LSD, and I didn't know what to say, so I just said that. What do you think about the idea they're going to fake an alien invasion in order to bring about the New World Order? And that was back in the 80s, so I was introduced to that idea very early on, and that would be my reason for skepticism now, I guess. Also, not coincidentally, it's, I think, the subject matter, or rather, the subject matter of Strieber's TV show, Hunters, or Alien Hunters, whatever, is alien terrorists, so it's conflating the two there. But yeah, my reason for skepticism would just be, hasn't it been around too long for it to fly? I don't know if that, I honestly don't know if that would make a difference. It would make a difference for me and you if they announced that we were under attack by aliens tomorrow. We would both think, well, are we?
Yes.
Right? So, but would that, I don't know if that would make any difference, because as you said about terrorists, I didn't believe, I've had a paranoid mindset as far back as I can remember, to be frank. I grew up with it. But it's certainly translated into parapolitical awareness for, if I give it a generous term, or just general paranoia. In my 20s, it translated into a more specific kind of inability to trust any of the narratives. So when 9/11 happened, there was never a time where I believed what they told me on the news anyway. But that obviously hasn't made any difference to the efficacy of using the threat of terrorism to implement social agendas. It doesn't matter what I believe. It doesn't matter what all these people are speculating about on YouTube and all the rest of it. I suppose the question is whether it can invoke the necessary emotional response. And it seems that for an alien threat, it would have to be something a lot bigger than 9/11, or it would have to be something more intimate in some way, where people actually felt, because an alien thing is the terror, and I have had dreams about this, though it may have been incepted in me by the culture, quite likely, but dreams about alien invasions, in which the terror was so immense. It was far, talk about terrorism, it was far more than just fear of one's life. It was, because it's the terror of the unknown. So it would be necessary to simulate an experience of something alien. You couldn't just say the aliens are here and show some pictures of them, because we've seen it all on TV, and it seems it was desensitized, and so I feel as though people wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would have to be something quite overwhelming. I have no idea what, but.
Have you read Watchmen? The comic book.
No, I know of it, but I don't think I've read it, no.
Well, because that ends on the Ozymandias's plan comes to fruition. There's a lot of overlaps in what we're discussing, because it basically they biologically engineer this alien entity, which is huge, and they somehow implant it with these narratives that are generated on this island by all these writers, science fiction and fantasy writers, who are working away for decades, I guess, creating these psychic narratives, if you will, that are embedded in the creature, which is then teleported to from the island to New York City. So it's as if it's just appeared from outer space. It dies on materialization, and as it dies, it releases all of these psychic waves of information that the whole planet is kind of. It's kind of an internal invasion and an external one simultaneously. So everybody experiences the alien at this very, I don't know about everybody, I don't remember, certainly enough people for it to spread, you know, the experience to get conveyed of something truly otherworldly.
That obviously
So,
that's
yeah.
fiction, yeah. That's written as fiction.
That
Yeah.
is written as fiction, yeah. Yeah, Alan Moore. He took his name off the movie, and they took out the alien from the movie. They didn't have it end that way.
Because certainly going back to the psychic experiments, I have read of group experiments in which it's like putting people's common imaginations about creating a fiction, creating a group fiction. And it actually had effects, had physical effects, apparently. I don't know if you've read about it. It's in Canada, I think, in the 70s. And this, I think, was connected with the nine, some involvement with the same sort of group of people. But it was, I think, in Toronto, and they called the entity Philip. And they created a history for Philip. They created a house, which was a photograph of a stately home in England. And they had a whole backstory about what happened to him and his family. And then I don't think there were any visual manifestations, but there are a lot of sort of oral manifestations which occurred over, and I think it was filmed, or some of it was filmed, apparently, and it occurred over a few months, and then the group dispersed. So it would seem, and I don't think that's the only example, but it would seem that this sort of, I was speaking earlier about psychic energy, it seems if you have, and my own speaking personally for a moment, I mean, I had a personal experience with a group of others with a Ouija board when I was a student, and something, again, nothing visual, but a presence, and well, maybe it's best to call it an energy, as I think it came from the mind, okay, or the brain, came from ourselves within. And with you know, we didn't use planchettes, we used an upturned wine glass, and if someone was writing it all down, it was making perfect sense in English sentences, and someone kept a record of it, you see. And then at the end, this is all very late at night, early hours of the morning, and at the end, after about 3 hours of this, the wine glass, it was quite a large room, and the wine glass just went at enormous speed to the corner of the room and smashed. That was after about 3 hours of, going around, and no one, because I was one of the people with my fingers on the wine glass, and no one was pushing it. It was an energy which was kind of, it wasn't there without us. Obviously, we were inducing it. I think it was specific to one of the people in the group, but it was like not just her alone, because without the other people, it couldn't, that energy couldn't present itself, couldn't sort of express itself. So the more, it's like the more people added to it, the greater the energy that was created. And that, none of us were experts or anything. We weren't expecting anything to happen, but we were all in a kind of, that's perhaps why it did happen, because we weren't sort of tense or anything. We were very relaxed about it. And I kind of think the mood helped as well, the mood that we were in. Kind of very low key, mellow sort of mood that helped it occur. And it's
Well,
never happened again.
it's certainly food for thought. It's brought to mind the argument that Strieber has made, which I write about in Prisoner Infinity, which he claims to have got from John von Neumann, that whatever this presence or this energy is, it needs our belief in it to access this realm. And the possibility that, because, you know, my experience of Strieber now, I mean, how I understand my experience of Strieber was that reading his books incepted me, to use that term again, with narratives or imagery or somewhere between the two, not exactly visual, but it's almost like a mood or a flavor that then caused some part of me, or allowed some part of me, to generate the experiences. Okay, so they were dreams, and that's, you could say, well, it's very straightforward. You read a book and then you dream about it, but they weren't ordinary dreams. I believe that they were real experiences. Some of them I was awake at the time, I just, you know, mentally awake but physically asleep, as in sleep paralysis, and so on. So I interpreted them anyway as real experiences, whatever they were. And I thought that they were confirming the truth of Strieber's narratives to some extent. But now I have to question that, and question whether somehow my belief in Strieber's narratives and his ability to persuade me of the reality of them allowed me to generate the experiences myself. In which case, you know, what's the limit to that? I mean, it's possible that we're being incepted with beliefs and narratives and imagery and feelings and whatever it is, this mysterious kind of psychic matter through the culture, that we're creating the event ourselves. And then if we get triggered collectively by whatever it is, some kind of trauma, I guess, then we would dissociate, to use a term that, you know, could mean many different things, but anyway, that we would somehow generate the reality that would rescue us, even though it would be a negative reality, because it wouldn't really rescue us, but it would rescue a part of us that doesn't want to see the truth. And so then we generate the fantasy that the social engineering requires in order to bring about the end result. You see what I mean? I never thought of this before, but it does seem That would be then, it wouldn't be either or, it wouldn't be real or unreal, it would be a mixture between the two.
One.
Three.
Hey, Neil, we can see you coming down the ladder now. Okay, I just checked get back up to that first tip. Not even collapsed too far, but it's adequate to get back up. Roger, we got me. If you take a little jump. I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lamp foot beds are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches. Although the surface appears to be very, very fine grained as you get close to it. It's almost like a powder. Ground mass is very fine. I'm going to step off the lamp now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Five. Now, I remember listening to someone talking about he's high up in advertising, and he was saying something about you cannot change reality, but you can change perception of reality. So I'm not sure, maybe that's what we're talking about. And this anthropology theory I work with about how we became human or how we became culturally human was all about deception, but it's deception not on an individual level. So, because if you just deceive on that level, you can't share it. But if you can somehow create a deception that's shared, so it's like a shared fantasy, shared deception is a fantasy as well, and then what you've got is a new reality then.
Yeah, supposedly. I mean, it's a blurry area, isn't it? Liminal again, because the reality is unchanged, but we've created a bubble that protects you from reality in which you can completely believe that it's real.
Yeah, but it has to be something that's shared with other people, and that's where the energy arises as well, because if it's just on an individual level, you can be sent to a psychiatric hospital or something, you know.
Well, even as a group, of course, you can be branded a cult and have your complex burned to the ground or whatever.
That's right. But it's interesting, isn't it, that the people in America who have had cults that have perhaps they've been potential rivals or you know, that so they had to be destroyed before they got maybe too powerful. Not that they probably would have done, but maybe the thing that might happen in the future is something like that, only it's not going to be stopped, but it's going to be allowed, and because it's going to be a new way of somehow arriving at a future that's different from where we are now. It's a bit vague, but I think...
Well, it may be that it's happening, and that it's vague because it's not localized. So if you think about the UFO alien cult, let's say, belief, meme place, whatever, it's not local. It's just spread out throughout our culture. So you can meet people anywhere and everywhere who believe in the Space Brothers. They're not part of a cult, but and yet they are part of this belief system, if you will, or I'm not sure what we're talking about, this group fantasy that you're talking about that may actually be able to spill out into reality in some way, like become infectious. You've got mimesis and Gerard and whatnot. I mean, like, how much is mimesis a subtler thing than action and relates to belief and perception itself? If enough people believe in an idea, then, and the right cues come where those believers say this is it, and then they start adding their own perceptions or their own projections to it, then that could snowball perhaps and infect the whole collective.
I mean, going back to what I was saying earlier about resource scarcity and the difference between Huxley's view and Orwell, or the Brave New World, relying on sort of plentiful resources, I think, that kind of view of things, and then 1984, it seems to be a much harsher vision of scarce resources. And so it's like, in order to make us agreeable to moving from abundance to scarcity in a kind of more overt totalitarian kind of system, then something needs to happen. Of course, we have terrorism. As I say, something else, I think, needs to happen as well. Well, possibly as a kind of plan B, if the terrorism narrative is failing to work, And also, I've read this in, or listened to people talk about this in terms of a new world currency as well, and things like we've got financial, you know, we nearly had a global financial collapse in 2008, didn't we? And who knows whether that's going to, I don't think that's gone away, actually. I think it's actually going to happen again. And that might be the catalyst that brings about this plan B. So that's why it's probably like sort of waiting in the wings almost to be activated. Of course, I have no idea whether it will work. It could actually be a sign of desperation, on behalf of the people controlling. Because that's one of the things about paranoia and so on. You assume that people are in control of things, and it's quite possible that this is not really the case. If we live on a... That was one of the other things about your narrative at the end, when you do mention about the end of the consumer society and things were being a lot better if we didn't have this sort of passive sort of consumer society that's sort of not at all creative. But
if do I mention that?
I think it's near the end. I was just trying to find it in, yeah, it's near that you talk about capitalism and the culture of consumption, and then talking about space colonization program to prolong capitalist values.
Right.
So that's where I kind of so it's also going into maybe the reason, the motive for all this sort of seeding of these different memes to do with sort of aliens and UFOs and so on. And as I say, it could be not that these people are, who are, okay, they are in control at the moment, but it's quite possible that there might in the future be no one in control, and then you have a view of chaos, and you have a sort of a vision of chaos in which we don't have anyone.
Well, everybody would be tearing each other's limbs off, probably.
Well, that's a nasty thought, isn't it? Because I was just discussing this with people recently in the pub and saying that, like, you know, because things I've read that can say that if we have a next economic or financial crash, then there seems to be very little that can be done to put things right. So maybe this is what is waiting as a kind of desperate way of making people continue to abide by, you know, like the rules of whatever, the law and order, you know, sort of civilization, civilized rules.
Well, I mean, it is possible. I was saying about maybe Huxley reached a point where he decided that it was better just to keep the masses placated and compliant, that was better than the alternative. Well, I was talking about more in terms of him believing that there was no way that they could individuate anyway, but it could also be, there could also be an awareness or a belief that the alternative to herding the masses is something much worse, like, you know, mimetic rivalry that leads to mimetic violence and that basically leads to the apocalypse in the most kind of profane sense, as in people just fighting each other tooth and nail for just for a scrap of food or whatever it is, or for a woman. I mean, we don't actually know, of course, but I mean, those who have dedicated themselves over centuries to kind of mapping the ways in which tribes adapt to the environment and societies and civilizations rise and fall, they may know something, or they may believe they know something, and this may be, it may not be entirely about just them wanting to maintain their lifestyle and have a slave force, which we haven't really got into, but that's clearly what's implied by, if you, you know, otherwise, as I say, why not just move to the island and let the masses devour themselves? Well, the answer is it's not enough just to have resources, you need people to actually work the resources and turn them into, you know, the means to sustain your lifestyle. So it could be that, it could be that they want to sustain a certain level of lifestyle for themselves, and they have to keep herding and tricking the collective into maintaining it for them, or it could be something that is more, I hesitate to use the word benevolent, but more rational, let's say, less self-serving, which is just about that they can't think of a better way to prevent civilization from consuming itself. I'm just throwing that out there. I certainly don't want to be end up being a justifier for social engineering, but I think it does pay to consider. I mean, that's the end of Watchmen again, is that when they realize that they fail to prevent the villain from carrying out his plan, they simultaneously realize that they failed to prevent him from saving the world. So they're like, what did we do, you know?
I think there can be narratives in which you have a hero who, you know, as we would traditionally see, a hero is someone who can save things, and actually ends up failing completely. I was just thinking, even there have been Hollywood narratives like that. I suppose the film Chinatown has that kind of, there's a realization at the end that there's nothing that he can do. But then the more recent film in French called The Bastards, I think it's the English translation, which is a very, very, very good recent French film, which I could see parallels. I think it's probably a better film than Chinatown, actually. But it's the idea that we think we can save things, but it's actually because we have a very limited, we're on the outside, we don't see the full picture. The people who are in the darkness as well, the so-called darkness behind the scenes, who have in a way a bigger picture, and so what we see as evil, they would see as necessary, because the alternative would be worse.
Right.
They
don't have the full picture, though.
Well, I suppose no one has the full picture, because they are, I suppose, making a judgment.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
They're choosing, it seems to me anyway, that they're choosing a false reality over reality because of a preference. Even if it's philanthropic and seemingly benevolent, they're still saying that we have to avoid the reality, whether it's that human beings can't live together in this numbers or whatever it is, or the earth can't sustain us, or this does seem to me an underlying drive to dissociate and reject the body, which is just can never work. Like you say, like control, we can't, you know, yogis can control their heart rate and all the rest of it, but they still die. So it's, we can't actually control the expression of life. Right? If we could, then life would have ended long ago. Because, right? Yeah, there's always a self-sabotaging mechanism, I think, and that's what we were touching on earlier about. You know, the building cathedrals or building rockets to the stars, it's the same drive, isn't it? Really. It's the drive to get away from something that's intolerable. Not really to get to something, because we don't know what there is in space. So it's a gamble anyway.
I suppose with the cathedrals, people might have been under sincere belief that they were making something for greater glory, you know, even though they were probably like slaves, you know, going back to the Egyptians as well.
Yeah, the glory of God.
Yeah,
glory of, yeah, which stuff. Is back to communicating with the extraterrestrials or something along those lines. We have to create an externalized, an extension of ourselves in order to be able to reach God. Well, that's never going to work either, because God is, well... nowhere, right? It's, the whole idea that God is somewhere is insane, in my opinion. Like, there's no logic to that one. So, like, why would God prefer to visit you or talk to you in a cathedral than, you know, on the John somewhere, or in your garden hammock? Right? Those are all projections and impositions of a certain value set.
I mean, this could have been part of the reason for the control and control of the masses after the war, when it was obvious that I was just reading Jung, his book on flying saucers, about this earlier today in preparation for this talk, and he was talking about the crisis of Christianity, obviously, and he's saying that Dr. Schweitzer shouldn't be in Africa; he should actually be in Europe, trying to deal with the problem of loss of belief in Christianity in Europe after the following. The Second World War.
And who's so, Dr. Schweitzer?
Albert Schweitzer, who's a sort of humanitarian sort of missionary in mainly in Africa. He mainly spent his life in Africa, though, working with Africans. Apparently, someone with charisma. I don't know much about him, but he was a well-known figure, you know, after the war, as a sort of holy man, a bit like Mother Teresa, perhaps. So possibly one of the motives behind this sort of the counter, because remember that LSD, that's right, was first isolated in Switzerland, wasn't it? And its properties were found during the war. It's of hallucinogenic properties in I think 1943 in Switzerland. And so that's another link between Switzerland and post-war America and things that developed there. And so possibly this counterculture was a kind of, as we call it, the New Age, don't we? It was called the New Age movement, as a kind of substitute for the loss of religious, or specifically Christian belief in
right.
following the war. Which I think must have worried a lot of people. You know, worried a lot of people who were sort of controlling things, because they thought, well, if people didn't believe in God anymore, then what? How can we control what they do?
Because they would be more aware of the futility and of their lives as dictated to them by the elite, I guess, is what it comes down to, you know, that, and why the UFO is a suitable replacement as an object of hope and of longing and of salvation, even, which is the context that Jung writes about it.
Yes, in modern myth, yeah.
Yeah, and a religion. I mean, he talks about the religious correlations, like Kripal is doing with Strieber now. He talks about the correspondences between UFO phenomena and religious imagery.
Mm.
And also, I just read this book on Jung, The Aryan Christ, which ties him, of course, to what we were talking about earlier. How he seemed to be consciously desirous of turning psychology into a religion.
Mm-hmm.
Called it individuation, which is a term I use. I'm going to stop using it now because it's all tainted. That just seems to be a common drive there is to provide meaning. If you provide the meanings to people, then these are the guiding fictions. Then you know what they want, you know what they need, you know how to sell them your product. So I'm not saying Jung was doing that consciously, but I mean Alan Dulles was. So this is kind of this overlap between Machiavellian manipulation, sort of grandiose mission, and naivete and delusion.
Yeah, and who knows how many people are taken in and how many are not. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I would guess that more people are beginning not to be taken in, and there's a quote that I read again years ago when I was a student, and it stayed with me, from an American poet, Wallace Stevens. He said, "The final belief is to believe in a fiction which you know to be a fiction, there being nothing else." And I've grappled with that, because it seems to be very, very, very difficult, if not impossible, to believe in a fiction which you know to be a fiction. And I've spoken to someone who's a Christian. They said he could never understand that.
Well, that's because they believe, right?
Yes.
But then I don't, I don't believe that, what you just said, that quote. Mm. I mean...
Well, I don't know if I do or not, but it's fascinating because I always think of that. I think of that quite a lot, and it's...
Maybe we're being trained by movies in a way to do that willing suspension of disbelief, and maybe that's part of how the alien, if there was an alien staged event,
yes,
staged invasion, that would be perhaps part of how it would work, is that we've been trained to volunteer, is the word, no, consent, to consent to the fiction.
And I like films which give me that suspension of disbelief. I don't like films where I don't get that.
You mean that let you know that they include you in on the process?
Well,
or that they just do it for you, like outright fantasy. I mean, outright, not necessarily fantasy, but I mean you just get swept away by them. Or you mean more like meta narratives where you're aware that you're watching a movie, but you're...
Well, I think that would be the great challenge, when you're aware of watching a movie, but you're still swept away by it at the same time, and that's very difficult to achieve. But I think I mentioned to you there's a French film called Lola, Jacques Demy, which I think that film achieves it, and that's why I was so fascinated by that.
That is the kind you like, then. You like to be included in that process of adopting beliefs just to see what they feel like.
It's like having, knowing it's a fiction, but believing in it nevertheless. And that's such a very difficult thing to achieve, because it's usually either or. You've either got to believe it and you're swept away into a fantasy world, or mm-hmm. you're completely detached and looking at it critically and intellectually without any emotional involvement. And it seems to be most films are either one or the other. But so it's right. maybe I shouldn't say film. It could be an experience then, you know, because then you've got.
I think that's the experience of my experience anyway, of the psyche as it, I can't say individuates anymore, as it becomes more conscious, begins to see through the crucial fiction. So I have an experience of behaving in ways that I know are reactive, let's say. I know I'm being reactive, and this isn't a way that represents who I am, but I let myself behave that way anyway, and so there's the experience of acting this way and of believing it, but then there's also an experience of watching myself acting that way and not believing it. That seems, in my experience, that's very central to becoming conscious of one's unconscious patterns and imprints and all of that, because we've been seeded with these beliefs, these narratives, unconsciously, at an unconscious level, so we believe in them, because to believe means you don't question. That's belief.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say, yes, I accept this Christ the Saviour, blah, 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 because so and so. You think you know, right? That's belief. Somebody who believes doesn't say, I believe this, they say, I know it. And so that's how they get us. Right?
That's unfortunately true most of the time with religious people. It shouldn't, if they're really believers, they should have doubts. They should have doubts at the same time, but usually they don't, yeah.
Okay, well, but it's, I mean, religious, this is in Prisoner Infinity, the whole notion of scientism. Religious, I mean, we can also talk about religion as a kind of mindset. Like, you can talk about scientific mindset. One can be scientific about art or religion or anything. One doesn't have to actually be addressing science to be scientific, if you see what I mean. In the same way, one can be religious about anything. So I'm religious, or I used to be religious about movies. I don't believe that The Godfather is a better movie than... I'm trying to think of something I really hate. Gravity. I know it's a better movie.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what is that? It's kind of aesthetic conviction. So it has that religiosity to it. So, But anyway, we have to round up, so I'm going to just try and round up my end. Anyway, with that is liminality, what you're describing, and also the experience, I think, in a work that I aspire to, I did with Prisoner Infinity, is that threshold between this is a narrative that is just the way it is and you're supposed to take it, and no, none of this is real and this is just a person writing or inventing or whatever it is. It's the threshold between, it's not about believing something and doubting it. I think it's closer to what you're saying. So you have an experience of knowing something, but you're also knowing that you can't know anything. That's liminality. So you're actually having to let go, not just of things that you know, but of the conviction that we can know anything. And that is what you were talking earlier about, people react. And I mean, nobody wants that experience because it's terrible, it's destabilizing to the ego. But I think it's liberating also. I know I have convictions that I will have to let go of, because yesterday's conviction is tomorrow's delusion.
The thing is, how much can we live with these? If you're talking about sort of maturing in a way, this is a kind of maturing process. I mean, how much can we actually bear? I mean, that's I was thinking of this quote from T.S. Eliot: "Humankind cannot bear very much reality." And I suppose everyone has their limits, and maybe the threshold is different for different people, depending on their, it's not so much their education or anything, it's more maybe they're just their background, their past, their history, their life history.
And the history of trauma also.
Yeah, we stop there.
Shall we stop there?
Yes, I mean, I could go on.
We could go on and on. Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world come tumbling down. I want your fireman, said the monkey, I want your prayer. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down. Here comes the monkey, the monkey speaks his mind. Out here comes the monkey. Here comes the monkey, and monkey speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling.